If you can wade into the political arena and make it out unscathed, you must be doing something right. Brian Burke is your host for Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Kitchener Today, Tuesday afternoon, the third edition from the Den. Thank you. It's not the Lion's Den. It's just the Den. Coming up this afternoon, we have another local Board of Education trustee who is running in the provincial election. Personally, I think when you do that, you should walk away from the board. That's not the law, though. Bob Hepburn, a columnist of the Toronto Star, thinks it should be, and he thought that 4 years ago. We'll talk to Bob just after 12:30 this afternoon. Remember the Trinity Bible Chapel? Of course you do. Well, guess what? They're getting their days in court. Started yesterday. We'll go for the next couple of days. Eric Adams, a constitutional law expert, will join us just after 1 this afternoon. We will hear from Premier Doug Ford the question and answer session. He had some interesting thoughts on a variety of things, including potentially a federal conservative leadership, because that seems to be in a bit of flux right now. Wicked problems. Government involvement in sport is fraught with issues. There's a surprise. Kyle Rich, an assistant professor of recreation studies at Brock University, joins us just after 2. And Shankaya Ramdev is the founder of Sweat Free Apparel. For those of us who may be inclined to get up and move around, and January was a terrible month for me, I can tell you that. We'll do that just after 2:30 on our Tuesday's Tech Spotlight. All that is coming up, but first, joined this afternoon from across the horizon, non-producer Paulie. How are you, Paulie?
Pretty good. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm not so bad. Ooh, you sound a little better. Are you using a fancy microphone today?
I am. I finally figured out how to hook up my fancy microphone to the fancy phone app that allows me to broadcast into the station.
Ah, okay. See, I just hook up on my laptop and go in through Zoom. It works fabulously. Although I'm not a big fan of working from home.
Yeah. So how long are you in exile for? I'm supposed to be back on Thursday.
I don't know. July, maybe. Okay. I am confused whether the 5 days ends today or whether the 5 days ends tomorrow. I think
we'll have to talk to the big boss man down the hall.
The Imperial Overlord. We'll speak to him a little bit later on today. It's you know, I don't mind it in some ways. I like it. It has the convenience of I can go and get coffee anytime I want, which I do. But it's just technologically, it's a little bit more difficult. But that's okay.
Yeah, and I can tell you, as someone who's been at the station during these remote broadcasts, there's always a few more tasks for me to do. So I always prefer that you're at the station, Brian.
I can understand that. Look, Tom Brady retired. And you know what I like about that the best?
For the second time.
Well, yeah, but I'm assuming
that
this
leaked out over the weekend, and then he goes, no, I'm not retiring.
I think what he'd said was he hadn't made a decision yet. I think that's what he said. But I'm actually happy.
He wanted to make the announcement. I don't think he wanted to be upended on it.
No, nobody likes to be scooped.
Yeah.
I like the fact that he's decided to quit almost on top. Right?
Yes.
Like too many times you see these people and they come back for one more year and the one more year doesn't go well. And that kind of leaves a sour taste. Or you see somebody who comes back because they want to get to certain milestones. And I've seen that in baseball a couple of times with Steve Carlton, who hung around for a couple of years too long. This is kind of nice. Walk out on your own terms. Good for you. And now
like we can TV show that, you know, hung around a couple of seasons too long, because that's what you remember, how bad it was at the end.
So that it's interesting that he's decided to walk away. Good for him. I figure you're never going to see him coach, because I don't think he has any interest in that. And I hope you never actually see him as an analyst, because he's not that interesting. He really isn't.
Well, players in general don't seem to be that interesting, but then after they retire, they all of a sudden have something to say.
Well, Tony Romo has been interesting from the very beginning as an analyst. I thought, I don't know if he does a great job, but he certainly does an interesting job. I got to give him that. And I'm just not sure Brady would be the same way. So anyways, good on him. Tom gets to retire with a supermodel wife and all his millions of dollars. Life is particularly difficult. The other thing, look, you're stuck at home till Thursday, so look at all the shoveling you'll be able to do.
Yay.
I'm trying to find the positive
really excited.
Here. Well, that's too bad. But remember what we had in January was that once in 20 years snowstorm?
Twice in a month. Sounds like we're going to get it again.
Twice in a month. Gotta love winter. I really do. Hey, this is interesting because I think it kind of got lost in the shuffle of everything as he waves his finger for the song. No, Polly, are we legally allowed to play this song?
Is this Hockey Night in Canada?
Yeah,
it's
the original Hockey Night in Canada theme.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll find out when we get a letter from the lawyer or not tomorrow.
It'll cost us a fortune. Ralph Mellenby passed away, and I think it kind of got lost in a lot of the other things that were going on. But if you enjoy watching hockey on television, well, thank Ralph Mellenby, because he started off at WXYZ-TV in Detroit in 1959, moved on to WGN in Chicago. So he worked for two of the biggest television stations in North America, then came back to Canada and Montreal and began producing NHL games in 1963. He is responsible largely for slow motion replay, microphone and camera setups all over the rink, so the viewer experience would be a little bit better. Also involved in the production of the Olympic Winter Games. He started off doing just hockey, then did a bunch of other things, including production for Summer Olympics in 92 and 96. He won 5 Emmy Awards, by the way, for his coverage of Olympic broadcasts. And he was really the guy who brought in natural sounds for the viewing audience, so you could hear the skis coming down the ski jump. And also part of the team that invented the world's longest television lens, which was used for ski jumping. So Ralph Mellenby passed away.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. 87 years old.
Why are the cameras kind of far away career. And they really have to zoom in or what?
Well, yeah, because these guys are jumping 140 meters.
Oh, right. Of course. And they have to zoom out because as they fly closer to you.
Yeah, got to be able to zoom in, then zoom out along the way. So he was largely responsible for putting the cameras actually on athletes. So all that viewing experience we're going to get starting this Friday, that's largely a result of Ralph Mellenby. So good on you. Oh, let's have a listen to this.
Polly Wally Doodle.
Polly Wally Doodle.
Polly Wally Doodle.
Polly Wally Doodle.
Let me clear up the confusion here. When Brittany's not here and we have no idea where she is, Polly steps in to do his little bit, and then we found a theme song, which is why we play that. What's on your mind?
Where did you find that? What is that?
That is Polly Wally Doodle. By Burl Ives, who usually only gets any music played at Christmas time.
Right.
But here we are paying royalties to the Burl Ives estate, I guess. So it's the only song I could find.
So, Brian, the public school board in Cincinnati has announced that Monday, February 14th is going to be a holiday for the school. It wasn't originally going to be that they announced yesterday that they're mending their calendar for the year because, of course, the Cincinnati Bengals are in the Super Bowl for only the third time in franchise history.
Wow.
So they're allowing students and staff to stay up late and not have to worry about getting up early the next morning to go to school. So isn't that nice?
I suppose that's just recognizing the reality, right?
Well, when are the Bengals again going to make it to the Super Bowl, right? It hasn't happened since, what, 1989?
Yeah, I believe it's 89.
More than 3 decades.
But there has always been this Super Bowl flu that's been around for a long time, right, where people will perhaps spend too much time celebrating their love of football on the Sunday, and they can't seem to make it in on a Monday. You know what?
Yeah, I think that's the one day of the year, more than any other day, that people coincidentally call in sick.
And the last couple of years have been a perfect cover for calling in sick. Because you call in sick, you get the entire week, right?
Yeah.
That's what happens around here. Well, good on the Cincinnati School Board. Because, yeah, I am, you know, when you think about it, like, look at the franchises that have been involved in the Super Bowl largely over the last 20 years. The Cincinnati's don't get a whole lot of love in that. So you guys should be able to celebrate. Don't. You know, really think about it. New England, been in there more times than enough. All kinds of other places, and this time it's a little bit different. I'm a sucker for the underdog story. Look, we are what, 2 weeks out from that, Paulie? So your bold prediction on the Super Bowl. Tell me.
Oh boy,
you could have two predictions.
You could have one with your heart and one with Cincinnati. You know what? I'm going to say Cincinnati because they've been an underdog the entire playoffs, and you know the LA Rams have also been a bit of an underdog, so it could be a toss up. But I'm going to go for Cincinnati.
Yeah, I see. There's a part of me that says, yeah, I really want to see Cincinnati do this, and then there's a part of me that says, Cincinnati, can I really actually buy into that? You know what? I'll go the other side of the ball just for the heck of it. I'll go to the other side of the ball.
There you go.
But I think it will be a very interesting game, which is always a nice thing because we've had way too many Super Bowl blowouts. That's kind of a world record for Cincinnati. There are some other world records. I was just checking this today that have been broken over the last few days that have not received the attention they deserve. For example, two guys in Iowa, of all places, have set a world record for the most passes of a beach ball in 1 minute. So that's not just handing it to each other.
To set that record.
Well, you know? I guess the guy who previously held it. Now, this is not just passing a beach ball back and forth. It has to be bumped, right? Like you would bump a beach ball. 157 in 1 minute.
In 1 minute. Huh.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Every half second. They must have been standing pretty close to each other to be able to pull that off.
Yep. Well, you have to have a minimum distance, and it has to not touch the ground. Of course, you can't cup your hands around the beach ball because that would obviously be cheating. But 157 times, by the way, they broke the record they had previously set themselves. So they not only decided to do this once, they decided to do it twice. They broke their own record. And also another record set in the wonderful world of citrus. Here goes.
Grapefruit, a bathing suit, chew a little juicy fruit, wash away the night.
I'm going to guess you didn't even know this was a potential record. A Louisiana supermarket has teamed up with a fruit producer to break the Guinness World Record for the largest display of citrus fruits.
Okay.
Right, there's the excitement I was looking for. Rouse's Markets and Sun-Kissed Growers say they gathered more than 40,000 pounds of oranges, mandarins, lemons, grapefruits, and tangelos at the Rouse's Market store in Metairie, Louisiana to break the Guinness record, which had previously been 6,000 pounds. Now, Metairie is a city of 143,000 people. I have no clue what they're going to do with 40,000 pounds of citrus, because you don't want it to go bad.
Now they're having a big fruit sale coming up for the next 2 days. Three for one.
Run a tractor trailer through the front window and have the world's biggest fruit salad. That would be the best idea. Also, congratulations today to Jonathan. Jonathan is a tortoise.
Okay, well, you got to be more specific.
Well, his name is Jonathan. He's a tortoise, and he is the world's oldest living land animal. Celebrated his 190th birthday.
Wow.
Now the oldest tortoise ever.
Ever?
Officially. Yeah, officially, the record title is Oldest Chelonian, which is a category which encompasses all turtles, terrapins, and tortoises. 190 years old. They say he still enjoys a certain amount of human contact. I'm not anywhere close to 190 years old, and I don't enjoy much human contact whatsoever. Also, out of South Africa, a young man there, 28 years old, has been practicing gymnastics since he was the age of 10, suffered a bit of a setback when he was 13 when he broke a hand. However, he has set a new Guinness World Record, 36 backward handsprings.
Okay.
Alternating his hands.
Right.
So one hand at a time, 36 backward handsprings, no more than 3 seconds between flips.
Wow.
That is very, very impressive. So alternating hands, no more than 3 seconds between flips. And he had previously set the record, now has set the record again. And because of that ability to go from one side to the other, he's now the front runner for the Conservative Party leadership of Canada. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Plenty to talk about as we go through the afternoon. Polly asked about where the Polly Wally Doodle song came, and that came, of course, from Burl Ives. Burl Ives passed away in 1995. He was, I think, 86 years old at that point. However, his songs continue to chart into the 2020s. Now, those are the ones that he is largely associated with Christmas, because he did famously narrate Sam the Snowman in the classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That's right, Sam the Snowman. Well, and see, if you remember, Sam the Snowman had a goatee, didn't he?
Yes.
Because that was Burl Ives' look. Burl Ives always had a goatee in most of his television and movie roles. He did win an Academy Award as Best Supporting Actor for, I believe it's Big Country was the name of the film, back in the late 1950s. So he had started off in vaudeville, then became a singer, then got into radio, then got into television, then got into film. And also was an honorary inductee into the Boy Scouts of America, because he was a scout before there was a Boy Scouts of America. He was an organization called the Lone Scouts, and they later on inducted him. And he also won the highest possible award for scouting, and supported scouting his entire life. So,
all right, cool.
Kind of an interesting guy. But how many people do you know whose music survives, still charting in the 2020s, albeit only at Christmas time? But Burl also was in A Holly Jolly Christmas and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. All of those things, they still chart even now. See, people have some pretty long and varied careers, and they last. Now, I know you and Mike talked yesterday, I think, about Howard Hesseman, right?
Yes, Johnny Fever, yeah.
Dr. Johnny, and I know awful lot of people in radio who say, hey, you know, Howard Hesseman and Dr. Johnny Fever, that was my inspiration to get into radio, which now most of those people who said that weren't in radio in the late 70s like I was. So it was a very, very, very different business in the late 1970s than it was today. You know, that was still the time when people would set your scripts on fire because they thought that was funny, and a variety of other things that happened over the years. And there certainly were Johnny Fever type characters. Not so much the case anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I worked with more than a couple of Johnny Fever type characters, perhaps not as out there as Johnny was, but you know, if you were looking for the kind of person who could, you know, walk in at 1 minute to showtime and then be ready to go, yeah, I worked with some of those people. So it's and did you ever watch the reboot of it, Polly?
No, but I've heard it's not nearly as good.
No, it was terrible. It was absolutely horrendous. It had a really good short run, and should never have been revisited. Actually, one of the things that interested me in radio was a movie years and years ago. Maybe you've seen it, Paul, called FM.
No, I haven't seen that one.
Came out about the same time, so you know. Interesting kind of state of the union on FM radio at that time, which it was really interesting for a while, because FM, when it first started, you really couldn't run commercials because it was too much of a danger to AM, right? And all the, and then you had policies that called the spoken word. So I certainly knew people when I worked back in the late 70s who would just read the liner notes off the back of an album. That was their spoken word. They just read the damn thing. You had to have a certain amount of spoken word content compared to the amount of music you were playing.
So, right.
With these incredibly long things on a format that was designed to play music. And then, you know, they moved on. So Howard Hesseman is gone. Some of those cast members are still around. I think Herb Tarlick, the sales guy, I think he passed away a couple of years ago.
Yes, yeah, maybe a year or so ago, yeah.
And, Gordon Jump, obviously, years and years and years and years ago, although he may have been more famous for being the Maytag repairman.
Yeah.
Everybody moves on. Paulie, thanks. Hopefully we'll see each other in real person at some point in the next of this week. But coming up, we will talk about trustees and why I think if you're going to run in a provincial election, you should step away from the Board of Education. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Well, the provincial election is just 4 months away, and the horses are being put together in the gate. Another horse announced yesterday, and Joanne Weston, who is a member of the Waterloo Region District School Board, she will run for the NDP, I believe, in Kitchener South Hessler. Trustee Karen Meisner also planning to run. Of course, Catherine Fife, former trustee, former chair of the Board of Education, is already the MPP for the riding of Waterloo, and this isn't reserved simply to members of the NDP. Others, conservative liberals, have had positions on school boards or perhaps councils and run again. Thing is that on the school board issue, you don't have to step away. You can continue to go to your meetings. You can continue to, what I believe, is use that as a platform. And no harm, no foul, I guess. Bob Hepburn is a columnist with the Toronto Star and joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Bob.
Hi, Brian.
4 years ago, almost exactly, you wrote this was a bad idea, and it's still a bad idea 4 years ago, 4 years later. Why doesn't anybody seem to care?
Well, actually, when I wrote that column 4 years ago, almost to the day, a lot of people did care. I got a massive response to the column where I suggested that it's a bad idea for local politicians, school board trustees, city councillors to run for higher office, i.e. running for either the provincial legislature or for a federal office in Ottawa. And the response was huge. But politicians at Queen's Park don't seem to want to enact measures that would prevent that from happening.
Now the rules are school board trustees. There's no worries there. They can essentially do whatever they want. And that's the same for municipal councillors as well, right?
That is correct. So a city councillor or a town councillor, they can run for another office. That's not allowed for provincial politicians. They must resign their seats if they want to run for an elected position, another elected position. For example, if somebody at Queen's Park wants to run for a seat in the Parliament in Ottawa, they must resign.
Are there laws in place in other areas, Bob, where this simply isn't allowed?
There are. As I said, in Canada, federal politicians can't run for another office. They can't run, for example, if you were sitting in Ottawa and you wanted to run for a seat in the Alberta legislature, you would have to resign your seat in there. It's also in place in many U.S. states, everywhere from Arizona to Florida, and as well as in some cities in the U.S. have actually put those laws into place, meaning that in places like Philadelphia, for example, a local politician, either a school board trustee or a city councillor in Philadelphia, cannot run for their state legislature or cannot run for Congress without resigning their seat immediately.
And it's problematic to me for a couple of reasons. One, it allows you to continue to use a platform, because if you're going to have a weekly or a biweekly or a monthly meeting from the school board, you can use that platform to get your name out there. And if we have this great desire to have new blood, and I think there is a feeling out there that it's necessary, it just puts that new blood at another huge disadvantage, because name recognition is gigantic, especially locally.
There's a number of reasons why this is a bad idea to allow local politicians to seek another office. And you've cited a couple of them. Sitting politicians, they've got a huge advantage just from name recognition. And visibility, which in local ridings and local areas are the two major reasons why people get elected. And second, another reason is that campaigns are time consuming. And if a trustee, for example, in Waterloo or Kitchener is running for, in this case, the Ontario legislature, that's time consuming to be on the campaign trail. While you should be doing the job that you are elected to, that you're being paid to do, it doesn't make sense to do it. I mean, my whole view on this thing is that these politicians, school trustees, or local councillors, they've already got jobs, elected jobs that are fairly well paid for, and they're being paid for that while they campaign for another job. It seems they don't want the jobs that they have any longer, and that they're openly seeking work elsewhere.
I don't see that there's any particular movement to change this anywhere, is there?
No, there doesn't seem to be at Queen's Park, and that's probably because a lot of the politicians at Queen's Park right now came up through this route. You know, they were school trustees, they were city councillors, in some cases they were mayors, and they've used those local positions as stepping stones to what they consider to be a higher job or a better paying job. There's not much pressure up there to do it. I mean, yes, you don't like the idea. I don't like the idea at all that they can do it. But people at Queen's Park, it's not a priority at all for them, just because many of them, I should say, came up through this route.
I've certainly heard this argument, you know, in favor of letting this happen in the past, Bob, and that is, well, if a trustee resigns from their seat, well, then, you know, the people are losing representation. I'm not entirely sure I buy it, but that's what I hear.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand what they're saying, you know, that, and yes, there would have to, in some cases, to be a by-election to fill that position there. But you're asking the public to buy the idea that, you know, a politician can have divided loyalties. And that's just not the way it should work. It's the way it does work, but it's not the way it should work. I mean, you know, if you're elected to one job, the public believes that you're going to stick with that job. If you think that eventually you as a politician think eventually you want to run for a higher office, either Queen's Park or Ottawa, serve out your term. Serve out your term and then run at another time. But this using especially the school trustee position as a stepping stone to something else to build up your name recognition, it's just flat out wrong. You know, they, as I said, they should quit their posts that they have now and then run, but not keeping these two jobs at one time.
Bob, thanks for your time today.
Okay, take care, Brian.
Bob Hepburn is a columnist with the Toronto Star. 4 years ago, he wrote the article because at that time, it involved a City of Toronto councillor who opted to run at the provincial level. And at that time, he was pulling in a solid $100,000 a year as a City of Toronto councillor. He would continue to sit on council until the election would be held. If we look at the situation that we're in now, we are on January the 4th. So we have February, March, April, May. We have 4 months. A little bit more than that until the provincial election. And the unfairness to me comes from, first of all, a couple of things. One, you have a platform which will be reported on through outlets like this and outlets like the local television station and the local paper. But, and I realize I've heard this before from people. Well, I can separate the two, but the reality is you have that platform. People who may want to run against you may not have access to that same platform. So I think we need to level the playing field a little bit there, as well as, and this is only recently becoming a thing, when we start to change the rules on election signs. And election signs are, well, they are a collection of litter. I get that. I don't like to see the miles and miles and miles of election signs. But by taking the opportunity to put your signs on public land away, you're once again handing an advantage to those who hold some level of incumbency. And that, to me, is another barrier for people who may want to run in elections and have at least a bit of a level playing field Now, obviously, at the provincial level, party still means an awful lot. It doesn't mean as much as it does at the federal level, because that is the most party-centric of all of our election systems. The federal level, that's what people follow. At the MPP level, it's still very party-centric, but there is room in there for that local candidate, especially when you have a situation like we do in the province right now, which is three very, very, very close parties heading into this election campaign. So that little nudge that you can get from name recognition, I quite simply think that it's wrong. Diane Freeman was on Waterloo City Council in the 2015 election. She took a leave of absence and walked away from the horseshoe in the time that she ran as an NDP candidate. She didn't win. She returned to council. I'm okay with taking that leave of absence. We're not talking about a huge amount of money for school board trustees. Yes, they do get a payment of some sort, but being a school board trustee does not pay like a full-time job. I am happy if you want to run for higher office. I'm not even demanding that you finish the rest of your term. In this case, approximately about 8 months, because the municipal elections are in October. Is it a disservice? Well, yeah, it is. But given the small number of people who vote in municipal elections and the even smaller number of people who actually vote for school board trustees, again, it's not like you're representing a particular group of people. And there are certainly other trustees from the city of Waterloo, et cetera, who can pick up that slack in terms of bringing issues to the board, if that's something that you're going to have happen. But to me, my preferred route is that you step away from the board completely and run in the election, which is fine. If you lose in June, you can always throw your candidacy back into it for the school board election coming up in October. So part of this has something to do with timing, but walk away and focus your time on that, as opposed to, well, and I've seen defense of it already. And one of the defenses is, well, everybody does it. Well, just because everybody does it doesn't make it the right thing. Whether you're liberal or NDP or New Blue or conservative, if you're sitting on a council and you want to run, step away. And it's unfortunate that that's not happening, because I think it provides an advantage. Now, on the other hand, if you are a trustee and you're stepping away, that's giving you something else. Maybe more time to go knock on doors. Maybe more time to go talk to people. All of those things may perhaps serve your campaign. And I understand the stepping stone idea of it. It's been around for a long time. You run for school board, you sit there for a term, then you maybe leap towards a higher office. It's happened in the past. Elizabeth Whitmer is a good example for the Conservatives. She was on the Board of Education, then ran and won as a Conservative in the riding of Waterloo for a long time. Catherine Fife followed the same path. I cannot go back in time and remember exactly how that played out in terms of timing and elections and who was doing what when. Can't remember. Sorry. Too bad. But here, when we're back in this place again 4 years later, because nobody wants to change it, because it works to the party's advantage. Yay. That should give us more faith in politicians. *570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
It doesn't make sense to do it. I mean, my little view on this thing is that these politicians, school trustees or local councillors, they've already got jobs, elected jobs that are fairly well paid for, and they're being paid for that while they campaign for another job. It seems they don't want the jobs that they have any longer, and that they're openly seeking work elsewhere.
Bob Hepburn, a columnist with the Toronto Star, wrote 4 years ago about, at that time, a City of Toronto councillor who had opted to run in the provincial election, yet still continued to maintain his job as a city councillor. There's nothing illegal about that. You can do it if you want. It's just the rules should be changed. Bob wrote that 4 years ago, and of course the rules have not changed yet because, well, the rules kind of fit what the party's looking for. You want to have candidates that can win, and they have looked at it and said, well, you know what, if you've got somebody who's already run and won at the lower level, that makes sense. But to me, the decision is relatively simple. I have no issue. I don't even have you have an issue with you leaving in the middle of a term. Bob has more of a concern about that than I do. I don't particularly worry about that one way or the other, because we have mechanisms that are in place. If someone needs to be replaced around a council table or around a board meeting, that can be done. We've seen that. As a matter of fact, when all of a sudden the Board of Education is picking a couple of new trustees, if you need to do that for a couple of months for representation purposes, then that's just fine. I just don't think it's particularly good that you make the decision to run on a provincial basis and then you continue to hold a seat around a Board of Education table, where I have no issue with you making the decisions. I have an issue with you using it as a platform. And even if that platform is as theoretically non-problematic as simply being around the board and getting some extra publicity, it's still problematic. And it does, I think, restrict some people from deciding to run. And I think we should have more people run all the time. It's not a particularly easy job. I don't pretend that. There's a lot of information you need. And one of those things you'll need to understand is that you are never going to make everybody happy. And you can never try to make everybody happy, because you quite simply can never make everybody happy. That is the nature of sitting, you know, on a municipal table or at a board meeting table. And it is part of the playbook for parties to search out those people on those boards and councils who are prepared to take that further step forward. And if you want, move up the chain to a bigger job, I don't know, air quotes, more important job. It happens all the time across all parties. Now, right now we happen to be in a bit of an NDP phase, because we have at least two members of the board who will run for the NDP in the provincial election. Now, look, this is 4 months out. 4 months is a long time. That's a significant time frame for you to get your boots out there, for you to get your name out there, and do all of that work. And as someone who benefited from a little bit of name recognition in my short council tenure, it really does come in handy, because there were plenty of doors you could knock on where, if nothing else, the name is familiar. Comes in very handy when you're looking at a ballot. Now, I think it comes in really handy if you're looking at a school board ballot, because oftentimes we're sitting there looking at 7, 8, or 10 names. Maybe one or two of them we recognize. Maybe for those of us who maybe are a little bit more connected to the way things are going on, we might recognize 4 or 5 of those numbers. And quite naturally, we have a tendency to lean towards those things. So if we needed to have a rule, and I don't think we actually need to have a rule, I think we just have to have people do the right thing. But if we need to have a rule, which they do have at higher levels, it's when you announce your candidacy, you need to step aside. You need to step away. Do you need to resign? I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but I think you certainly need to take a leave of absence from board meetings so you will not sit around the table. I don't have an issue with that. Is there a concern there that you won't be representing whatever the term constituents means, especially in a Board of Education setting? Yeah, there's a bit of a concern there, but I don't think that's as much of a concern as, say, if you step away from a council table. But if we want more people to run, we need to give them that opportunity, you know, to at least have a reasonable shot at it. Now, nothing is going to change being prepared to work hard, being prepared to knock on as many doors as possible. I've seen plenty of people win elections when you maybe think they wouldn't have had a shot, quite simply because they outworked everybody else. That still has some value. But I am not sure that board trustees who decide to run for another position are so much saying, well, I'm tired of this job and I want to find another one. My sense is that they would be more along the lines of, I feel I can do more at a higher position, which is perfectly legitimate. There are no issues there whatsoever. Just step away. Although we already have a couple who have opted not to step away. And I know there will be some defense of that. It's a really weak defense, as far as I'm concerned. It holds virtually no water whatsoever. And I think people would have more respect for you if you just simply walked away for a while. And like I say, the example I used before was Diane Freeman from Waterloo City Council, who ran for the NDP and stepped away from council during the entirety of that time, which is perfect. It's fine. That's all you need to do. Columnist Bob Hepburn says what we need is a resign to run law. And there are some of those laws in places in other jurisdictions. Makes a certain amount of sense. But of course, when it is self-serving to all of the parties, all of them, not just the government party, there's virtually no impetus to make any kind of a change. Coming up just after 1 o'clock this afternoon, it was probably a year ago, right? I'd have to check back in our records, but we were all talking about Trinity Bible Chapel and their, well, difficulties with the restrictions that were in place in Ontario. That has found its way into a courtroom in St. Thomas. Both Trinity Bible Chapel and Aylmer's Church of God have started their arguments. It's a challenge of public health restrictions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Lawyers argue the measures violate the right to freedom of religion and assembly under the Constitution. And according to our guest coming up after 1 o'clock, they might be right about that. But that's not the entire story. And coming up a little bit later on this afternoon, we will talk about, the business of politics and government, more particularly in sports, and sweat-free apparel as part of our Tech Tuesday segment. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Last spring, the spring of 2021, we heard an awful lot about Trinity Bible Chapel here in Waterloo Region, who ran afoul of COVID restrictions and were, of course, fined, etc. A great many things happened, and they weren't alone in that. The Church of God in Aylmer was involved in much the same situation, and sooner or later, this is going to show up in the courts, and sooner or later arrived on Monday. A challenge by the two churches of public health restrictions began on Monday. Their lawyers arguing the measures violate the right to freedom of religion and assembly under the Constitution. Eric Adams is an expert in constitutional law in Alberta, and there is no better way to start one today than a discussion of the Constitution. Eric, thanks for coming on board.
Brian, that's how I begin every one of my lectures, and and the students look at me the way some of your listeners are now staring at the radio.
Well, you know, at some point we knew it was going to come to this. So we've had one day already. What do we expect to hear from, I guess, the church side to begin with?
They'll be arguing a series of arguments that have been coming out at a number of different in a number of different ways through the pandemic, that basically what we have is government overreach, that the restrictions on their freedom to gather for religious purposes clearly infringe their freedom of religion and their freedom of assembly and probably their freedom of equality rights, and they'll throw in security of the person and the liberty rights as well. And they'll say all of it amounts to a deep and unreasonable limitation on their rights as citizens that the government cannot justify.
And that really is the rub, right? Because there's not much doubt that those restrictions infringed upon the freedom to gather.
I think that's right, and I'm glad the charter has been interpreted in precisely this way. Courts really from 1982 on have said that the freedom of religion and the right to gather, those two things are part of our fundamental freedoms as a free society, and that we're going to interpret those very broadly, so that if we just take freedom of religion for an example, the court has said any kind of religious practice, and basically anything you do that is can be described as religious in nature is protected. And so all aspects of religious ceremonies are protected. The right to gather for religious purposes is protected under Section 2 of the Charter, Freedom of Religion. And it means that when a government says, as they have through the pandemic, in this kind of extraordinary interference, there's no doubt about it, that people can't have church services of this size, or that they have to have it outdoors, or you have to cap the numbers of people involved, or in some cases that the proceeding cannot take place entirely. All of those very clearly interfere with the broad definition of freedom of religion. The question in all of these cases has always turned on the second question under our charter, which is that rights are not absolute. Can the government justify those infringements given the context of the pandemic that we remain in the grip of?
And it's very clear that the charter is written in black and white, but it's not black and white either. That's where the judgment comes in on whether or not these restrictions were reasonable given the current situation.
Yeah, the courts have said again over 30 and 40 years of cases now to say that this decision about reasonability has to be guided so that it's just not completely open-ended. We need to make governments demonstrate that they have a good reason, number one, for limiting a charter right, and that's usually not that hard for governments to do, and certainly in a pandemic, they just point to the pandemic and say, there's our good reason. So the courts will say, okay, you've got your good reason, but now that second step is a little more tricky, which is, have you done so in a proportionate way? That is, have the government done it in a way that's reasonable given the risks that they were facing, given the unknowns in transmission, given the science and the underlying evidence on how COVID does and doesn't spread? Have they made reasonable, remember, not perfect, but reasonable limitations in an effort to deal with the public health crisis that is clearly amongst us?
And I suppose that can be judged in different ways at different times. The situation we had last spring, pandemically speaking, seems considerably different than the situation we have now.
Yeah, that's one of the real challenges both of governments, is that COVID is both a moving target with waves, and there are moments when things have seemed better, and then there are moments when things have gotten worse, and we've certainly seen governments yo-yo their restrictions. And is that sensible good policy as they try and deal with the ups and downs of COVID, or is that has that been a negative because it's you know, called into question the public's trust in the restrictions? It's hard to say. There was no playbook here for governments to follow. They probably, you know, did the best they could in the moment they had in front of them with the information that they had, and some governments have maybe done a little better than others, but all of them have probably attempted in good faith to try and balance the difficult interests that are at play here, keeping people safe, in particular vulnerable people. And we know that people over the age of 70 are more vulnerable to COVID than younger Canadians. Also the harms that restrictions cause, including to religious practice and to people gathering. But at the same time, recognizing that that people also have a right to be free and healthy, and that letting this virus simply run rampant through the public was going to cause immeasurably more pain and immeasurably more harm to our society. And so how do they drive that line? Well, they've tried their best, and now a court of law is going to review it by saying, okay, was it reasonable what you did? And virtually every case that has already raised these issues, and there have been a number of them, where churches and other groups have made similar arguments about the interference, and again, courts have agreed, yes, your freedom of religion is being interfered with. But in all those cases, the courts have looked at it and said, we don't see governments acting unreasonably. They are acting reasonably given the state of the knowledge of COVID and given the uncertainties of the harms that this virus might cause.
Those cases that you talk about, Eric, have they been related to the pandemic, or are they from previous times?
There is a developing case law directly on the pandemic. So we've already seen at least three or four cases in different jurisdictions. The latest best example comes from Manitoba, where a group of churches challenged in a very similar way as we're seeing in Ontario now, that the Manitoba restrictions on gathering, including on indoor and outdoor gatherings, interfered with freedom of religion. And after a lengthy trial and a lot of evidence, a decision released a couple of months ago now, said that the government was justified in the limitations that it had imposed. Similar arguments are being raised today, and there is a hope, I think, amongst litigants and the lawyers that that like these kinds of challenges, that at some point we reach a stage in the pandemic where some court is going to say, okay, but we're now so deep into this pandemic that the level of restrictions are no longer justified, that we've got to change to deal with an endemic situation, that the rationale of immediate safety is no longer as compelling as it once was, and so now these restrictions go too far. I think that's the hope that churches are pinning their expectations on, is that at some point we reach that trajectory in the pandemic, at least from a legal standpoint. Whether we're there or not, I'm not sure. I think it's still going to be very difficult for any court of law to look at the number of deaths and the hospitalization rates. And I've got a brother that works in an Ontario hospital, and I'm sad to say there's a lot of people in there, and there's a lot of people dying of COVID-19. So we can wish away that fact if we want, but it's a fact, and that evidence is going to be in front of the court when the government makes their case.
Ultimately, as this is adjudicated, Eric, how does it go up the chain, if it goes up the chain at all?
Well, it's a long process, so sit down, get out your popcorn, and wait a couple of years is basically how the legal endeavor works, because we're just at the start of this 3-day hearing, I believe. There'll be some period of time before a decision is rendered. At that point, then there'll be a question of whether or not either the government or the litigants, the church groups, appeal the decision, and then you might be on to different levels of appeal, and then you're into many more months and possibly years. So my hunch is, Brian, that at some point one of these cases is going to reach the Ontario Court of Appeal. One of these cases from some jurisdiction is eventually going to reach the Supreme Court of Canada. If the pandemic continues and if restrictions continue, we're going to continue to see challenges of the restrictions that emerge. There's nothing new about that, and I think that's also healthy. I mean, we live in a society of the rule of law, and we're allowed to test the constitutionality of government action, so I don't think there's any problem there. It's the system working as it should. But if anybody thinks that a court is about to, remove all restrictions and vaccine mandates, I suggest that the track record to date suggests the very opposite.
But I guess a case like this at least paves the road for future decisions in some way, if it gets all the way to the Supreme Court and a court at that point decides, yes, these restrictions, were unreasonable. Does that change things down the road?
Yeah, well, Brian, it depends on when this pandemic is going to end. I mean, what my true hope is that all of this case law we're generating is basically irrelevant, hopefully, in the near future, because the facts here are so particular. We've just, of course, never dealt with anything legally like this before. And earlier cases but from the pre-pandemic era were, of course, helpful in terms of the concepts. But at the end of the day, the question of whether or not the government was reasonable in the ways that it restricted rights because of this dangerous disease are completely unique to our legal history, and you got to go back a long, long time to dig up even cases from 100 years ago about vaccines and smallpox to even be in the ballpark. So this really was uncharted territory, of course we are building a series of cases in different jurisdictions, and Ontario will be no different. We'll get a number of cases. The Ontario Court of Appeal will weigh in at some point, and we'll see what what use that provides for the future. But my really, I suspect your listeners are the same. I mean, I just hope to goodness that at some point all of this seems like a relic of a very strange moment in our history.
As a constitutional law guy, this, though, the last couple of years has to be kind of the Super Bowl of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, because we've had more discussion about that in the past 2 years than we had in the previous 40.
Yeah, I would gladly give it up. I got to tell you, I would trade it for my boring old life. I counted my media interviews last year, and I was in the over 100. And so yes, the charter has been front and center in this these debates. Sometimes it's been misunderstood, and I think, you know, the events in Ottawa this past weekend give some indication of that. I mean, it's easy to declare that you have a right to something, but of course the charter is a more sophisticated, nuanced document than that, because as you said at the opening, it's about protecting rights and about limiting restrictions to reasonable restrictions, and that nuance gets lost in a lot of signs that people can wave above their heads. But at the same time, it's also been, I think, important that these conversations keep happening. You know, the Constitution belongs to all of us, not just to courts and politicians, and it's important that people are defending their rights. That's something that we should be proud of. But it's also the case that people need to know that the Charter says you've got a right to freedom of religion, and I'm glad it does, but reasonable limits are an essential part of living in a free society. If anybody can do whatever they want whenever they want to do it, your society's a lot less free, I can tell you that.
Eric, thanks for your time today.
Yep, all the best.
Eric Adams is a Vice Dean and Professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Alberta, Trinity Bible Chapel, and the Church of God in Aylmer, heading off to court. They're into the second day of the discussions now. So it is really a two-part discussion. And one is, were your rights infringed upon? Full stop. The answer to that, according to every constitutional law expert I have read, is probably a solid yes. Actually, not even probably a solid yes. It's way over on the yes side. Absolutely, yes. Your rights to practice your religion were restricted. But there's always another part of the question, and that is, were those restrictions reasonable based on what was happening at the time? So this will go through this court system, and then it will probably go up the chain, and ultimately we'll get something at the Supreme Court level. Now, we know that doesn't happen quickly, and it will give us an answer of some type. What that answer will be, still a little bit more up in the air. And when we talked about Trinity Bible Chapel and others last spring, this was one of the topics that we touched on. What would happen when it eventually came into the courts? Well, it's there in the courts now, and a decision, of course, probably still quite some time away, even from this court level, but eventually up to the Ontario Court of Appeal, then perhaps to the Supreme Court of Canada. That could be 2 or 3 years down the road. And at that point, maybe the amount of time we're spending on the Constitution and the Charter of Rights will have diminished to some degree. But it really is an interesting court case when you break it into the couple of pieces that are there. Star 570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
They'll be arguing that basically what we have is government overreach, that the restrictions on their freedom to gather for religious purposes clearly infringe their freedom of religion and their freedom of assembly and probably their freedom of equality rights, and they'll throw in security of the person and the liberty rights as well. And they'll say all of it amounts to a deep and unreasonable limitation on their rights as citizens that the government cannot justify.
Eric Adams, constitutional law professor, University of Alberta, is Trinity Bible Chapel and the Church of God in Aylmer, head off to court for their case. They're not the first case. They probably won't be the last. Jason, go ahead.
Early March there, or like March of 2020 and stuff like that, I'd say that they had the I'd give them the pass on that because they really didn't know what they were coming up against, so they needed some time to kind of figure stuff out. But we've had lots of time to figure it out. We've seen that the passports have failed. A lot of our restrictions have failed. Other places that have dropped all the restrictions, they're not, the sky's not falling. So I'd say the restrictions now are definitely just a violation of the Charter of Rights. The vaccine mandates, I see no point in those, being that the spread, whether you're vaccinated or unvaccinated. Hey,
that's nothing to do with the church case, Jason.
And then to get the grounds on what the charters, how to interpret it, I'd say that there's one surviving member of it. What was it, Brian Pickford or something?
Brian Pickford, I think. Yeah, the former premier of Newfoundland.
Yeah, every time I hear that name, I think of Robert Picton. But
it's Pickford. Let's make sure that we're right about it. Then maybe that'll take that away from you.
Yeah, two totally different people. But he was the last surviving member to do that, and he's now suing the Canadian government, saying that they violated it for travel bans and stuff. So I'm going to say that that's
That doesn't make him the expert on the Constitution, Jason. And his case will go the same way. It'll go all the way up, and we'll see what happens. Because that's the
way it works. There's going to be a lot of people in trouble, especially the ones that are continuing to fire people over vaccines when the vaccine's no longer stopping public's
transmission. All right. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate the call. Got to go to Debbie. Debbie, go ahead.
Hi, Brian. So I'm actually calling in for about the same thing with Brian Pickford. He's on YouTube if anybody would like to watch it. Speaking about the charter, and yes, he's the last one around that knows what all went on around the tables as they were drafting it. So it doesn't make him the expert on it, but it does. It's better. He was there. And when I watched this, his statement that he made, and let's not forget, he knows he was in Parliament. He was the Premier of Newfoundland, and I don't know if he's a lawyer or not, but nevertheless, he had a very good suggestion in there. And instead of having to start at the bottom with your local courthouse and your local jurisdiction, that there are provisions within the Charter of Rights that allow a case to be brought directly to the Supreme Court, especially when it's something that is as important as this. And he gave an example of a way that they did it when he was Premier of Newfoundland. And for water rights or something like that, I don't remember exactly how it was. But if you watch that YouTube, it tells exactly how to do it. And he said the difference in this case, if it were to be taken directly to the Supreme Court, is that you don't have two sides suing one another. What you have is the Canadian government asking for a ruling from the Supreme Court and that is the body that the government has instituted specifically for this reason. So, I mean, we're paying them the big bucks to have a Supreme Court justices sitting on the Supreme Court. So why are they not taking advantage of having that done? And it would be over and done. And he did also say in his speech that it doesn't guarantee that in all cases you would have automatic access to these things. They do look in the charter when it was designed, was intended to look at when there are extenuating circumstances. Yep. So I can't see that anybody would, whether you're a pro-choice or a vaxxer, a pro-vaxxer, it's one way for us to come together. And that was the same as with what's going on in Ottawa. And just quickly, one thing I'd like to say, when Trudeau was denigrating the 10% of truckers, he was praising the 90% who brought us our food for the last 2 years, and they carried on and did all of this work. And he just basically just, like, it was like just slapping them in the face and infuriating anybody who was listening, because those truckers, whether they were vaxxed or not, and there wasn't 90% in the beginning, they just all kept doing their job. And that 10% worked just as hard as the other 90% that are vaxxed. And they were bringing our food and our traveling our highways and keeping us going, our economies going. So for him to say something like that was just inflamed. Everybody should be up in arms about that, because that was so uncalled for and so divisive. Like, first of all, he's dividing society already into vaxxers and anti-vaxxers, and now he's trying to divide the truckers once again against one another. And
Debbie, I have to let you go. I'm already well over time. Yeah, I appreciate the phone call. Yeah. Thanks very much. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. As you heard on Luke's newscast there, challenges for Erin O'Toole at the federal conservative leadership level. Generally, around the liberal or the conservative fold these days, you get one election, and after that, you're in danger of being turfed. In the case of Patrick Brown, who was the leader of the provincial conservative party, you don't get any election whatsoever. But O'Toole is facing that challenge. There is a process in place. Where that will go, don't really know. O'Toole had a very interesting response to it in terms of which direction the party goes, but that has been an argument within the Conservative Party. You go back almost 30 years, you know, to reform and the Progressive Conservative Party, and then whether Stephen Harper managed to cobble together enough people to run his own Conservative Party and win a few years in government. And now again, there seems to be that split that is threatening to happen. How do you deal with that and have continued electoral success? Kind of glad I don't have Erin O'Toole's job these days. The leader of the Conservative Party of Ontario is, of course, Premier Doug Ford. He had an event today, making an announcement on long-term care and a question and answer period, where for the most part, people didn't ask about the announcement on long-term care. But we thought we would take the moment, given on what has happened in the past few days, to let you have a listen to the words of Doug Ford from his question and answer session today.
Hi, Richard with City News 680. How you doing, Premier?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Certainly noticed a change in the way you describe the pandemic in the last few days. You've talked about learning to live with the virus. You've talked about returning to life before COVID-19. Yet the science table came out with new modeling this morning that said cases will rise as the current restrictions ease, and hospitals are strained, and they're going to become even more strained. So my question for you is, when you talk about learning to live with the virus, does that mean we're never going to see the type of lockdowns we've seen the past few months? Or what will you do if hospitalizations become troubling again, sir?
Yeah, it was Dr. Moore that said we got to learn to live with it, and I agree with him. But what we're doing, we're putting more money into the healthcare system. We've created 3,100 new beds. We hired 6,700 new healthcare workers. Another 6,000 are on the way. We're building long-term care facilities, rapid builds like this right across the province, investing billions of dollars. We're putting billions of dollars into new hospitals across the province. So are we ready? Yeah, we're ready. We're ready to move forward, but we have to do it cautiously. We can't just jump into it and just open everything up tomorrow. We have to be very, very cautious. We have a strong plan. It's great news that we're opening up, moving forward. We're opening up on February 21st and then March the 14th. But again, make no mistake about it. The hospitals, they're in better shape, but we still see a little bit of absenteeism. We're still seeing pressure. We're still getting surgeries back up and going. So we're going to be cautious moving forward, but we're going to get there.
Before I get to my follow-up, I just want to be clear. Lockdowns, sure. We could still see it? It's still a possibility?
No, that's not our goal. Our goal is to move forward in a very cautious way to make sure we don't have to have lockdowns. And when we invest in the healthcare, there's one thing I keep saying for the last 4 years with all the other premiers from all the provinces and territories from all different political stripes. We need the federal government to pitch in. The CHT, Canadian Health Transfers. Folks, We're getting 22% out of the 100% that we're investing. There's no province, no territory that can sustain the funding. We just can't do it. So we need the federal government to step up and contribute more than 22%. We need ongoing funding from the federal government because we can't take 78% of the burden. They take 22% of the burden and expect to continue to grow and fund the healthcare system.
Premier, I want to ask you about the trucking protest situation in Ottawa. Yeah. I know you put out a statement yesterday condemning some of those actions. Yeah. Why did it take you till Monday to put that out? And what is your message this morning to the truckers that remain there?
Well, you know, my message right from the beginning of this pandemic when it came to the truckers, I appreciate everything they've done. I appreciate them bringing health supplies to hospitals, putting food on the grocery shelves. But there's three things I can't tolerate. Desecration of any war memorials or any memorials. Zero tolerance for that. You know, what people have to do, and the flags are waving around, is disgusting in my opinion. Outside of the greatest flag in the world, the Canadian flag. God bless them for waving the Canadian flag. But the other thing is, folks, there's a million people that live in Ottawa. You know, I hear you. I hear the protesters. The province hears the protesters. The country hears the protesters. Now, it's time to let the people in Ottawa get back to their lives. These businesses that have been closed for a while now, the restaurants want to reopen. So, you know, I get it. I hear you. But we have to let the people of Ottawa live their lives.
Hi, good morning, Premier. Our colleagues in Ottawa have confirmed that no one from your office nor from the province reached out to the mayor's office in Ottawa over the weekend to discuss the situation. Mayor Jim Watson received a call from the Prime Minister, as an example, but no call from you. So what does that say? I mean, you seem to publicly be telling the truckers to go home, but privately you're not offering any kind of support to the city of Ottawa.
Well, I disagree with that. We have great ministers out right on the road, right in the field. Minister McLeod said a very strong statement, and we have Minister Fullerton there. We're well represented.
But no matter if it's
Jeremy Roberts and Goldie Gomari. I did put a statement out. I put a very strong statement out yesterday. So at any given time, if the mayor needs our support, he knows where to contact us. He has my cell number, and I put a strong statement. I'm putting a strong statement out today that people have to, you know, move on, let the people of Ottawa live, let the businesses open up, and that's my statement, Colin.
Okay, another question related to Ottawa. Yeah. I'm sure you're well appraised of what's happening within the Conservative Party currently. The question for you, obviously, because a lot of people have been mentioning your name as a potential successor to Erin O'Toole if things go that way. Do you have any plans whatsoever to step into the Conservative leadership race if there is a race now or sometime in the next four
years? No, I have my hands full. I love being premier of this province. We're going to build this province, and I'm going to continue leading this province. That's my job. I am just, you know, 24/7 working on getting us out of this pandemic. I want to unite this province. I can't stand this divide. When I see this divide in this country and in this province, I want people united. And we're going to get there. We're going to get through this together. We're going to get through it cautiously, but we're going to be united at the end of the day.
Hi, Premier. Matthew Bingley, Global News.
Hey, Matthew.
You talk about the cautious, phased approach to reopening the province, but with the science table pointing to cases that are likely going to rise as we see restrictions ending, and businesses that obviously need people's support, how can you both walk the line of saying, get out there and support businesses when we don't have the healthcare capacity at this moment yet? You know, you want to, it seems like they seem to fly in the face of each other.
Well, not necessarily. You know, there's no secret. We have the toughest guidelines in North America. In North America, as everyone's moving forward, we're being cautious. We're making sure we beef up our hospitals with the staff that are needed and well overdue, with 6,700 healthcare workers that we hired, another 6,000 coming on board. We had built 3,100 hospital beds and building billions and billions, spending billions of dollars building new hospitals, building the infrastructure that's needed. But do you know who's an expert on this and showing strong leadership from day one, standing shoulder to shoulder with me, is Minister Elliott. Maybe I'll bring Minister Elliott up. Has done an incredible job, Minister of Health.
Well, thank Thank you, Premier. First of all, we do have capacity in our hospitals, and the science advisory table has basically indicated that it appears that the peak of Omicron has passed. That doesn't mean we're entirely in the clear, of course. We still do have high levels in both our hospitalizations and intensive care units. However, that is starting to decline. This week we've had about 3,000 people admitted to hospital. Last week it was over 4,000. We have capacity. That's why we're doing things like releasing Directive 2 somewhat to allow for some of those procedures that people have been waiting for some time to continue. We're opening up pediatric surgeries, cancer screenings, making sure that we can let independent health facilities operate, private hospitals. All of those things are possible because we do have the capacity that the Premier mentioned. We have created over 3,100 hospital beds, over $5.1 billion, 67 new healthcare professionals into our system, so that even if the numbers do go up slightly as we start opening up, the modeling has been done to indicate that we will still have the capacity to deal with that increase, but also to start to deal with the people who have had procedures or surgeries postponed. So we feel that we are ready for whatever will happen as we move forward.
I have one more question for you, so don't put the mask on yet. When it comes to those surgeries that you're talking about, not all of those procedures have been given the green light. When will people who are waiting and have been waiting for months and months and months actually get a definitive answer when, as you mentioned, cases could go back up and could delay those procedures even further?
Well, we are confident that we have the capacity to be able to open up gradually and cautiously in the same way we're opening up the province. Gradually and cautiously, we'll do the same thing with the release of Directive 2 in a tiered approach. We have four different tiers leading to ultimately opening everything up so that we can increase those volumes. And as you probably are aware, we put $300 million last July into extra operating times for evenings and weekends to allow us to help serve those people who have been waiting for a long period of time. So we're doing this very cautiously and carefully, making sure we have capacity for people who have COVID and making sure that we have capacity for people who need those procedures and surgeries. And with the information that we've received from the science advisory table and from Dr. Moore, I'm confident we'll be able to deal with that.
Minister, if you stay there just for one moment, thank you so much. Adrian Gober with City News. I'll ask a follow-up question to that. I was speaking with multiple families last week. One family, one gentleman has a sister who has a cancerous tumor on her kidney in need of surgery. He's a small business owner. He understands the need to reopen business, but he also understands the need for his sister to be able to get into a hospital. So while bars and restaurants and other parts of the economy are open today, but his sister's still waiting for surgery, what would you say to that family?
First, I would say that I'm very sorry that people have had to have surgeries and procedures postponed. I know this has been very difficult for individuals and their families. Some have been waiting for a long period of time. But I would also say that although we aren't able to continue with all of the surgeries and procedures right now, they are all very, very carefully triaged. So if someone has a life-threatening condition, they will still be served right away. And so we have many doctors looking at this to make sure that if this young lady were in a life-threatening condition, she would be able to have her surgery right away. So I think it's important to remember that everything hasn't stopped completely. The most serious cases are being triaged and moved forward as quickly as possible to make sure that their lives will be saved. Thank you.
Thanks. Just a question for Premier Ford. Premier, yourself and your government, you've repeatedly chastised the federal government when it comes to border measures. So would it be safe to assume that you then support the federal government's mandate on truckers, similar to the United States, that they must be vaccinated to cross the border? So a clear answer to Ontarians may be beneficial.
Well, I think I've made my statement pretty clear right across the board. I believe in getting vaccinated. You know, I've been on the trucker side, I've always supported truckers from day one, but I support vaccinations. It's very simple. That's how we've been able to slowly get out of this, and that's how we're going to continue to slowly get out of it. People may disagree, one side or the other, but I'm going to support getting vaccinated. And that's no shot against the truckers. I think the world of the truckers, I've supported them from day one and appreciate and very grateful of everything they've done and continue to do throughout this pandemic. Keep in mind, I think it was close to 90% of the truckers are vaccinated, right? So I want to thank all of them.
Okay, we'll move to the phones for questions now. First question, please.
From Karen Howlett at the Globe and Mail.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Premier. My question is about the upcoming Council of the Federation meeting this Friday. Yeah. You and other premiers will be calling on the federal government to, as you mentioned earlier in your remarks today, to increase funding under the Canada Health Transfer. There are advocates who are saying that any increase in federal funding should be tied to national mandatory standards for long-term care. So here's my question. What is your position on Ottawa's plan to introduce such long-term care standards across the country?
Well, before I pass it over to the Minister of Health, we're strong believers, number one, all of us, is health is the jurisdiction of the province. In saying that, if the federal government wants to give us additional funding and saying we want to allocate it to long-term care, we welcome that. But really, for decades, and this is decades, it's not this government, it's that this government, the previous government, they're pitching in 22%. We've been preaching this for 4 years. So we got to make a move on this, and the federal government has to pitch in. We've spent billions and billions of tens of billions of dollars throughout this pandemic, and yes, they've supported us on one-time funding. One-time funding doesn't cut it. We need continuous funding all the way through for many years to come if we want to sustain the increase of money we're spending in health care. So I'll pass it over to the Minister of Health.
Yes, health care is the responsibility of the province, and as the Premier indicated, if the federal government wants to give us some money for long-term care, well, absolutely, we will take it. But the primary problem is the Canada Health Transfer amount is too low. At 22%, it doesn't cover the increase in costs that we're sustaining in health care, and as the health care budget increases, of course, that means other important parts of what the government has jurisdiction over, education, infrastructure, everything else, we won't be able to invest those dollars. So what we need in health is sustainable funding through the federal government, increase it from 22%, far above what it is right now, because among other things, we're having great medical discoveries, great innovations, great new medications to deal with rare diseases, things like that. Our healthcare costs, our drug costs, our building costs, everything's going up. So we're appealing to the federal government to help us so that we can have a strong, healthy health budget as well as the rest of the items in our provincial budget.
Follow-up, and this is the last question.
We'll take a break from Premier Doug Ford's news conference. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Not much of Doug Ford's responses had a whole lot to do with whatever announcement was made on long-term care today. It still continues, of course, to be an issue and will be an issue right through until the provincial election in June. Politics are everywhere. They are, of course, also in sports. We will be joined after the break for a discussion on that with Kyle Rich from Brock University. He writes in the conversation about wicked problems with sports and politics. We'll be back to have that discussion in just a minute. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
You may be big and fat, or uglier than sin. All the ladies shut you out. You're wondering how to get in. Well, here is my advice for how to make a splash. You can have your pick of gals if you've only got a mustache. A mustache, a mustache. If you've only got a mustache. A mustache, a mustache, a mustache. Big mustache, thick mustache. My mustache, your mustache. Say the word mustache.
A mustache, a mustache.
Now we both have said mustache. A mustache, a mustache. If you've only got a mustache.
Well, that song always lifts my spirits. It's just stupid, and I like it. We're expecting 25 centimeters of snow over the next couple of days. Maybe reason enough to dig the snowshoes out, strap them on, and once again, go to Conquer Mount Perimeter, just around the corner from me. Maybe that's my step into the world of sport governance. Kyle Richard is Assistant Professor of Recreation and Leisure Studies at Brock University, writing in the conversation about the, I can't really say it's a politicization of sports, but government is certainly involved. Kyle, thanks for joining up today.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me.
Interesting, as we head into Olympic season, which is as political or governmental as sports ever gets, people are, I think, more comfortable with government involvement in sports, aren't they, when they start to understand exactly what it does?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we do have a federal sports system in Canada. So we have a branch of government that is responsible for sport participation and getting folks involved. And that also involves, you know, these high level athletes as well who represent Canada at the national and international level.
You make an interesting point in your article. You talk about, you know, we watch these quadrennial games, Kyle, or they're supposed to be quadrennial. It's not quite working out these days. But we watch these Olympic games and we talk about the trickle-down effect, how it gets more people involved, et cetera, et cetera. What's the science on that? Do we know if that actually makes a difference?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. There isn't really clear evidence either way that this is a thing that is sure to happen. There's lots of different data sets that have some different indications, but it's not a reliable thing. We can't say that just by having an event, there will be a demonstration or a trickle-down effect that will result in more participation across the board. And there's lots of reasons why this is really difficult to measure. So one is it's really hard for us to measure if people are just changing sports. So, you know, you may say, oh, we have the Winter Olympics, and then look, there's so many more people registered in hockey, but does that mean that that's just because they left soccer and moved to hockey? We don't really have the means to make those really clear comparisons that way. And it's also really difficult to measure informal sport participation. So we really don't know how many people, strap on the skates and go play at the outdoor rink, or, take up running on their own, not part of a club, as a result of these. So there's the potential that it happens, but it's really, really difficult to measure. And therefore, we don't really have clear indication of if it works and how it works all the time.
Well, I imagine too that it's tied to a few other things. It's tied to success, for example. Nobody wants to finish 67th in the bobsled, for example. And it's tied to accessibility of that sport and tied to the usual issues around demographics and social position, right?
Yes, totally. One of the really important things that we see or we talk about is awareness and first contact. So often large games can have a really important impact in that they make people aware of different sports. So you mentioned bobsleigh, and that's a really interesting one because municipalities don't have bobsleigh tracks, right? If it weren't for these big events that get a lot of media time, folks wouldn't really be aware of those events and that they exist. So they do play a really important role in making people aware of what's out there, what these possibilities are. But then that next step, so that idea of first contact, is also really important, because if you don't have a means of accessing it, then it's really difficult for you to get involved, even if you would like to. So sports that are less common, maybe more difficult to access, particularly if you get further away from big urban centers. You know, it might not be easy to Google a local speed skating club, for example, even though it's a fairly common activity. If there's not a speed skating club near you, it may be really difficult for you to have that first contact opportunity. And then, as you noted, this is further implicated along lots of kind of social position lines. So there may only be club for young males, you know, or there may be large barriers to entry in terms of cost and how much it costs to have an opportunity to participate, whether that's equipment or even just accessing facilities. In a lot of cases, it can be really difficult for folks who just want to try something out.
And we've also seen some things that were gender factors in. I spent a lot of time as a high-level fastball coach for girls and women, and also administered that organization here in Waterloo. And the drop-off when girls would reach 13 or 14 was just, it was actually incredible how many young women would drop out of it at that point. We still haven't addressed that.
Absolutely. There's, you know, a range of factors that play into these. And it's not, I would say it's not an exclusively sport issue, right? This is reflective of kind of our, the broader way that we treat these things in society, the broader messaging around what's acceptable or what people should be doing. I think that right now there is a really interesting kind of shift happening where we're really coming to recognize and celebrate women's sport more, and that's really important, right? Elevating these women athletes who are amazing role models for young women is really important, and I think we're coming to do that more, and I think we need to do more of that if we want to address issues like drop-off.
We tend to put these templates in place, Kyle, I think, where, you know, well, here we've got this great big blanket, and we'll stuff this on top of everything, and it should work, but that's not going to work in a country like this, is it?
Absolutely not. You hit the nail on the head there. So a one-size-fits-all approach isn't a super effective way to improve sport participation, whether it's for kind of general populations or for specific populations like we've kind of been discussing. So, you know, what works in downtown Toronto per se may not work in Timmins in Northern Ontario or in Medicine Hat, Alberta. So we need to think about these things in a way that's a little more context specific, right? So recognizing what local demographics are like, what local cultures are like, what local people want, and how we can support them. So what these sport activities work for some for in different communities is really important to consider. So rather than thinking that we can just you know, scoop it all up and fix it with one program, we really need to think about the people who are at the receiving end of this. And what's going to work for them in their communities if we want to build these kind of sustainable sport participation patterns.
And if we build those, then we perhaps get a sense of, you know, whether or not we are, as just a general population, participating more, taking part more, because it's good for us. And we can, you know, get rid of that image of that old participation commercial, if you remember it, the 70-year-old Swede who could outrun all of us Canadians. If we have that kind of policy, maybe we find out if we actually are getting more active, because that's the goal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And another really important thing is thinking about how we evaluate this, right? How we're monitoring and tracking that, and how we organize sport politically at our different levels. So, you know, at the municipal level, what are we looking to achieve with sport and recreation? At the provincial level, how are we organizing sport? Are we putting it in with public health, or are we thinking about it as an economic and tourism development opportunity? Certainly, there's opportunities for it to do many of these things, but we need to just think clearly about, you know, why we want to engage in community sport, and then figure out how we want to measure that, right? How are we going to say that that's successful? What is it we're looking to achieve? So those are some really important points for sure.
I know we talked a little bit about the highest level and whether or not there is a trickle-down effect, but there really is a, as you put it, professionalization of sports in this country, even at the very lowest levels. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, so that's a tough question. I don't have an easy answer for that one. I think there's certainly pros and cons. So with the professionalization or modernization of our sports system, you know, we do have better access to some resources and capacity, particularly in different communities. So if you look at, you know, a coach in a small community that may not normally have access to a lot of resources, we now know that that's coach has the same training as someone in a large urban center, because we've got a kind of standardized system across the board. So it does open up some of these opportunities that way. But it also causes some problems, because what it does is it downloads a lot of that professionalization onto the people in sport clubs, so in the communities who are required for organizing those participation opportunities. So if something, you know, if a club used to be a mom and pop club that was organized at a kitchen table, it's a lot more difficult to do that now, because you need a certain level of skill, some organizational skills to be able to, you know, navigate this professional system, maybe get some training, and to be able to check all those boxes. So definitely some opportunities, but also some challenges that come along with that professional system.
You talk a little bit about politics and sports in your article. I just want to jump on that for a second. As the games in Beijing open, I wonder if these, you know, kind of look like the most political games ever, despite the efforts of everybody to take the politics out of them.
I think that's hard to say. I think Olympic Games have always been very political, and we've seen a lot of different reactions. You know, so we've seen Olympic boycotts in the past. We've seen the athlete activism at a variety of games, and this happens very often. So I think it's tough to say the most political games ever. I think they're certainly reflective of the politics that are inherent in the Olympic Games and you know, what they are all about. So yeah, I would just encourage people to read up on some of those kind of historical events and what those, you know, what those have been like, and then just draw some of the parallels and to see how sport is continuously politicized and the Olympics is part of that big system.
Yeah, and I often look at it as, Kyle, as sports has been not so much politicized as nationalized, because we look as a country at our success in the games, and we put that on ourselves. See, our system works. We can do this. That's not new. It's been around for years, but it's still interesting how that plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. There is certainly this these ideas of nationalism or citizenship that are kind of attached to this. You know, in Canada, we often see it around hockey, right? We think of Canada as a hockey nation, or people as, you know, being very, very tied to hockey. And that isn't necessarily reflective of the largest number of people who participate, right? I don't think hockey is the most popular sport in terms of people with skates on playing in organized leagues. It is definitely tied to these identities, and that's a really important thing to recognize. And there's also some really interesting examples of other countries who have worked really hard to kind of shift their thinking around this. So if you look at Norway, for example, Norway has kind of reorganized some of their structures to really value and promote multi-sport participation. So athletes who play many different sports as they're developing. And they've seen huge success in this, in developing kind of versatile athletes that sample different sports and programs. And they've seen huge success, particularly in the Winter Games, by reorganizing their system and thinking differently about how they can support sport participation.
And you mentioned the thing about hockey and how we tend to latch onto that, and you also mentioned about levels of participation, and then you watch the Canadian men's soccer team and look what has happened there, you know, with development, participation, and then ultimately success. Look what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And another great example of this is basketball. Right. We had a while ago, we had Vince Carter and what they called the Vince Carter effect. And then we had all of those people who came through the NCAA system and attributed a lot of that to this inspiration of Vince Carter. And now we've had the Raptors recently do really well. And I think, you know, basketball has had some interesting kind of cultural shifts, particularly around the GTA, that will likely also affect both participation as well as, you know, how we think about basketball and how we see identities related to that. So it's certainly a really interesting thing, and it will be interesting to follow moving forward and in the future.
Well, it's been kind of cool, actually, to watch what I would call the urbanization of basketball in Canada. That's been a real thing in the United States for years, but it's only recently here.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's lots of things I think that contribute to different sport participation trends or kind of movements. And another important thing with basketball is accessibility, right? So where something like hockey has many barriers to entry, it's really not easy to get all the equipment and to get engaged. Basketball is much easier to kind of pick up. The facilities are much easier to access, and organize participation opportunities are much easier to access. So I think these are wrapped up in a lot of those kind of social positions like we talked about earlier as well.
Kyle, thanks for your time today.
No problem. Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Kyle Rich is an assistant professor of recreation and leisure studies at Brock University. Writing in the conversation about government involvement in sport is fraught with issues. I really am interested over the years in looking at the changing landscape of, well, sport watching to some degree, in this country, where for years and years and years it was hockey and nothing else. And then all of a sudden you see what happens with the Raptors. And that certainly, I think, draws people towards the game. And look what has happened in soccer. Our national soccer team was an international embarrassment for a very, very long time, despite large numbers of kids certainly getting into soccer and more of the better athletes getting into soccer. All of a sudden, This is a team that, barring perhaps the biggest collapse in FIFA history, will end up qualifying for the World Cup. which has not happened to this country in 35 years, and perhaps not only qualify for the World Cup, but I wouldn't say for a second threaten to win it, but certainly be competitive, something we haven't seen in a long, long time. And all of a sudden, there's this level of interest that we had not really seen before. And of course, we all take a certain amount of pride in the work that our Olympic athletes do, because when we start watching that from Beijing, of course, we will be looking at that and saying, this is pretty interesting. We wouldn't have a pretty solid bobsleigh team without the facilities that we have now in Vancouver and in Calgary. We wouldn't be anywhere close to that. So putting the facilities in the right place and getting participation involved. Kyle mentioned about Norway and what they have done in terms of multi-sport, people taking part in multiple sports. That's probably the direction we need to go, but it's not that simple. Want to be a downhill skier? You know, Kitchener-Waterloo probably isn't the place where you're going to end up doing most of your training. You might start off here, but perhaps not stay here for too long. It's an interesting situation to watch the demographics change over the past few years. Star 570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
One of the really important things that we see or we talk about is awareness and first contact. So often large games can have a really important impact in that they make people aware of different sports. So you mentioned bobsleigh, and that's a really interesting one because municipalities don't have bobsleigh tracks, right? If it weren't for these big events that get a lot of media time, folks wouldn't really be aware of those events and that they exist. So they do play a really important role in making people aware of what's out there, what these possibilities are.
Al Rich from Brock University writing in the conversation about government and sport, somewhat different from politics and sport. Of course, the Olympic Games, I'm going to say, get underway. It's not Friday when they get underway. In fact, it's in the next day or so that things get underway. They start off with some mixed curling, Canada involved there, taking on Great Britain in their first match, and then women's hockey goes as well. That's prior to the opening ceremonies. They will take on the Swiss, the dreaded Swiss team, a little later on this week. Opening ceremonies set for Friday, and then the rest begins. Beijing, certainly from what I've seen over the years, can be kind of a cloudy, gray, dull city at this time of year, so maybe they've spruced it up a little bit. There was a very interesting article out of the CBC the other day talking about their plans for their reporters, because they are sending some reporters to Beijing, and they are being provided with cleaned laptops and phones because they are concerned about what could happen to their electronics when they are there. So they're provided with those when they go, and when they come back, they are completely wiped for security reasons. Now, they also say that this is not an unusual thing for them to do when they go into any country, just because they are being careful about what happens. But they also point out that it is a very tightly controlled loop in Beijing. Reporters who go, both for sports and for news, are very much restricted on where they can go, as opposed to, there were restrictions certainly in Tokyo too because of COVID. But when you've gone to other Olympic Games, you basically land in the city and you're generally free to wander around and go find whatever you want to find. That is not the case in Beijing. You are essentially restricted from your hotel room to the press center to wherever your event is being held, and you are being asked not to interact with the locals, etc. All of those things happening at the Beijing Games, which may make them a little bit joyless, maybe a lot bit joyless, but at the very least, there is a competition to watch. It should be interesting in many ways. I'm still fascinated to see what the men's hockey team can do. For some of those guys, it's going to be maybe a chance to get back to where they were before, or to maybe increase their stock for the next season. And it has, perhaps to some degree, leveled out the playing field for a lot of different countries. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the Chinese national team, because the IOC had concerns that it wouldn't even be close to competitive. I think it might surprise a few people. On the other side, sweat-free apparel. Got a solution for that. But this is a Waterloo company as part of our Tech Tuesday Spotlight. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Talk about me.
Well, I am working away here to get to the right spot in the multitude of emails, which happens every day. So I make sure I'm saying the right things about the right people at the right time. It is our Tuesday Tech Spotlight, and despite the onrushing great white snow shark that is on the way for Southern Ontario over the next few days, our Tech Tuesday Spotlight shining brightly because we have had a couple of days of good sunshine. I'm joined this afternoon by Chenkaya Ramdev, who is the founder of Sweat Free Apparel. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have obviously picked the most descriptive name ever for a company. I quite simply have no questions. It tells me everything right from the name. What is it all about?
That was exactly the point for naming it, so I'm glad it went right there. But the way we started was I used to study at University of Waterloo, and while studying there, all of us had to do co-ops and internships. And one of my co-ops was in Hong Kong, and as you might guess, Hong Kong is very hot and humid. But on top of that, my employer wanted me to wear a suit. So I would arrive to work drenched in sweat, and that's how the idea for the startup came, where I was like, we are living in modern times, like sweat stains is something that should have been solved hundreds of years ago. So that's how we started with sweat-free apparel, which was meant to solve for sweat stains and managing sweat in general in our clothes. And that's what we were doing pre-COVID. And then when this crisis hit, we used the same technology that was meant to prevent sweat from passing through, and we put it into a face covering, and it helped prevent droplets from passing through. So we were an alternative to the cotton face coverings that everybody wore, especially in the early times when, I'm sure you might remember, like everyone was out of face coverings, and nurses and people who were on the front lines were using garbage bags to cover their faces. That's when we were able to provide our technology, especially to an organization named Metrolinx, which everybody must be aware of. They are the ones who run GoBus, GoTrain, all of the transportation within Ontario. And after that, now we are about to develop more stuff. And funny enough, it has nothing to do with clothes, so we have to come up with a new name soon. We are actually now building electrical boats that can be dropped into any lake, river, or ocean. And what they do is they clean up the lake. So the idea for that came because I came to know that especially since earlier there was a shortage, then there was overproduction and billions of disposable versions of face coverings, like the blue ones, have unfortunately entered our lakes, rivers, and oceans. And it is a huge pollution issue now. And I was reading an article a few months ago that they are reporting that soon there will be more disposable PPE in the ocean than even jellyfish. So now that's why we are building boats. And you can think of them as like electrical remote controlled boats, the toys that kids use, but bigger versions of that, that can be dropped into a lake, and it would clean up not just disposable PPE, but also plastic bottles, oil spills, as well as fish kills, which is when fish die, they reach the top, they float at the top, and they create very bad smell. So we will be able to clean up all of that. So that's so it's a massive pivot that we're doing, but that's at a high level what we do.
I would argue with you. That's not actually a pivot. Like you're not even close to the same place, right? Like how big are these electric boats?
So So we are still we're still building the prototype, but our aim is around 1 to 1.5 meters. So like we can drop a couple of them in a lake, and right now they are still remote controlled, but our hope is in the future we can make it like automatic, where like we just drop them off in the lake in the morning and pick it up in the evening, and the whole lake has been cleaned up.
And this was all a direct result of your waterproof fabric, right? Because this boat doesn't exist unless we have the waterproof fabric. Am I right?
So we are using even some other technologies in the boat, because like we have the full flexibility where we can our aim with that is just to like clean up the lake. So especially for oil spills, we are using socks that are generally used at the industrial level to prevent leakage. And we just put them in our boat. And another crazy thing that I feel your listeners will find interesting is that when we think of, for example, oxygen and carbon dioxide, we think of trees. Like trees absorb carbon dioxide and give us oxygen, which is completely accurate. But a bigger amount, so like there is new research coming out that says more than half of the world's oxygen is produced not by trees, but our water bodies, so our lakes, rivers, and oceans. So every alternative breath we take is thanks not to trees, but to oceans. The issue is, if there is any floating pollution in the ocean, then that process just gets blocked altogether. So that's why cleaning up the lakes can also help improve on the carbon footprint of a particular city as well. So that's like an added benefit apart from a clean lake.
So one of the questions I always like to ask people, Chankaya, is this where you expected your business to be a couple of years ago? I guess that's a fairly obvious answer, right?
Yeah, nowhere close to it.
But that's not the cool thing is particularly unusual.
Yes, and that's what keeps it fun as well. You know, like if you keep on doing the same thing over years and years, you just get bored. But like the challenges I face are like completely different to even the challenges I was facing last year versus the year before, that it keeps it fresh. Like it feels to me every few years we are launching a new startup, even though we are working on the same one.
And you're based here in Waterloo. How does that work out for you?
It has worked out amazingly because like the knowledge that I gained during university, we are able to apply now. And even the Metrolinx deal, it was because like, and I have to give them full thanks, is Communitech, because they were the ones who introduced us to Ontario government, and the Ontario government then introduced us to Metrolinx, and Metrolinx liked the technology we had in our face covering, which is why they gave us the order. So if it wasn't for Waterloo, if it wasn't for Communitech, and also another thing, University of Waterloo right now gave us the permission to use one of their lakes. It is the Columbia Lake, where the July 1st fireworks used to happen before COVID. So if it wasn't for the support that we've received from every level in Waterloo, like we would be nowhere compared to where we are right now.
You came here from India, right?
That's right. I came here as an international student, and it's funny. Like my relatives, including my sister, lives in U.S. So we would go visit them as a tourist, and then we would just come to Canada because my dad had one random friend in Toronto, and I just found people in Canada a lot more nicer than U.S. So when I had to pick a university, I was like, no, I don't want to go to U.S. Let's go to Canada. And that's how I ended up here.
And you worked at places like BlackBerry. And so this is just one of, I have lost track, to be honest, Shankai, of the number of companies in this town that have some connection to BlackBerry.
Yes. Back when everyone used to use BlackBerry, I was lucky to do an internship at BlackBerry. And the cool thing about that internship was it made us think like bigger than we would have otherwise. So I was lucky to work at BlackBerry once, as well as Bombardier Aerospace, which was like the coolest experience ever, because you would see assembly line, not of cars, but of planes. Like, it was the most massive thing I had ever seen. So because of Waterloo, we were able, like, I was able to get those internships. And because of Communitech, I was able to think of things in a startup way. So, like, sure, some people like to go to San Francisco for startups, but I think a lot better place to live and start a startup is right here in Waterloo. And that's why we are here.
I'm just reading through your website, and you talk a lot about fabric and textiles and how we got to polyester in 1941 and nobody ever did anything after that. So is there still that need to change the fabrics we wear to make them more, I don't know, consumer friendly?
So the funny thing is, when it comes to fashion industry, for them, innovation is introducing like old fabrics to a new market. So every generation, they either make products from cotton or they make products from polyester. But since the previous generation only saw the other products, so for them, it's innovation. And all the clothing companies, without exception, if you look at their leadership, the leadership is driven by accountants and financial people, which is great for the business because they can run them efficiently in terms of finance. But no R&D at all gets done at any major clothing company. That's why you'll notice most of the clothes we wear, we can swap one logo for the other, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference because they are made from same fabrics, they are made at same factories, and then they are sold at most of the same retailers. It's just the logo that is different. That is why we were able to have such a massive impact, even though we are a tiny, tiny startup. Like, I am sure, like, our company's entire budget is less than what these big companies spend on toilet paper for their employees. Yet we are able to have a massive impact because there isn't any innovation, nor are there C-suite execs rewarded for innovation. So, for example, if you compare like a tech company like Apple or Google, if they are not producing new products, then their CEOs get in trouble. But when it comes to clothing companies, there is no financial incentive. There is no stock bonus for them to come up with a new fabric. That's why no innovation happens. The only thing they focus on is how can we reduce the cost even further. If that means moving from China to Vietnam to Egypt to Ethiopia, they will move, and that's their only focus, reduce cost at all cost. That's what they think about.
Talk a little bit about the environmental aspect of this, Shankaya, because I notice on your site again that you were instrumental in reducing the amount of water needed to make a T-shirt. Why?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about the environmental aspect.
Sure. So, when it comes to environment, like, a lot of blame goes to the fossil fuel industry, and rightfully so. They are the biggest polluters out of any industry, but nobody asks who's the second biggest polluter, and that's the fashion industry. Like, it absorbs 10% of all fresh water every year, and it produces 20% of all the water waste. So a simple cotton T-shirt that, like, most of us are wearing right now needs 2,700 liters of water to produce just one simple cotton T-shirt. And for jeans, it's over 6,000. So an average person wearing a T-shirt and jeans is wearing 10,000 liters of water. And all of this water is fresh water. It's not ocean water. So this is water that could have gone in agriculture. It could have gone in other places where people need water, and most of the cotton is grown in developing world, which leads to water scarcity there. And once the cotton is made, and cotton is sent to these mills to be dyed so that the fabric can get its color, all of that dyeing liquid then gets released in our lakes and rivers. That's why, like, if you go to a clothing city, you'll see their lakes and rivers are not white or blue. They are green, pink, yellow, black, based on the color of the fabric that they are making.
As we, I know you made the masks, which are really cool. I also know you made the boats, which just fascinate me. Down the road, what will you do? Will I be wearing some of your apparel that has your technology in it?
So right now we are the face coverings is what we are selling because that's what everybody needs right now. But we are also doing big push in the boats. So our hope is in summer when everybody would be outside, they'll see our boats in at least local lakes. That is our goal. And our hope is that by end of the year, we can cover all the lakes in Ontario. And by next year, hopefully all the lakes in Canada.
That's a pretty big goal for a place in landlocked Kitchener-Waterloo.
The funny thing is, we are working on this, and as you mentioned, we are a landlocked city. This is something that should have been solved in Miami or any of the ocean cities, but nobody is doing anything about it. So we thought, let's do it.
Yeah, you know, and I think a lot of us over lockdown spent time watching all kinds of things, and to see some of the documentaries about the state of our oceans and lakes, it's pretty eye opening.
The oceans are dirtier than like what gets shown, and the benefit of our oceans is more than what anybody knows. Just like in terms of oxygen, like it produces more oxygen than all the trees and plants and forests combined, and most of the people would not even know that part. That's why there is like if you see trees burning, forest fires, there is an immediate reaction, and rightfully so. But we need to have even a bigger reaction towards organizations that are polluting our oceans. But like there is a disconnect there where people don't see what's the benefit of saving the oceans.
Shankara, thanks for your time today. Fascinating.
Yeah, no problem.
That's Shankara Ramdev. He is the CEO of Sweat Free Apparel, which doesn't really describe everything, except they pivoted over to sweat-free face masks, reusable, washable, waterproof, all the things you kind of want in a textile mask. I don't want to call it a cloth mask because that may not be entirely accurate. And now they're creating little boats, which will clean the oceans and the lakes. And that seems like a good idea on pretty much every level. And there it is happening in the fine seafaring city of Waterloo. Back to wrap up and look ahead. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Just taking a look at the weather radar, such as it is, and you see little fingers of snow or rain or whatever it is heading towards the top of the Michigan Upper Peninsula. And slowly, you hear the Jaws music in the background working its way towards us. We are expecting, well, pretty constant snow. From tonight through to Thursday, which we don't get all that often here. We had that big dumping a couple of weeks ago, right? And that certainly caused more than enough issues. Now, one of the issues, boy, if you thought it was fun before, getting around on some of the sidewalks and the corners and things like that, that's going to be nothing compared to the next couple of days because we're into the middle of this when we've had this 2 weeks of, you know, solid cold weather, well below freezing. So that snow is going anywhere. Yesterday was really nice. Saw a little bit of melting here and there right close to sidewalks. But now we're going to get another, well, even if it comes in at 15 centimeters, you've got to put the stuff somewhere. And I know for a lot of you, maybe you're running out of somewheres. That not surprising. Certainly seeing it along the streets that I tend to walk along, that there is not nearly the space to put snow that there is before. And that's a problem. Tomorrow, of course, is Groundhog Day, as is my want. I will ignore it because I absolutely, of all the days in radio, the one I hate the most is Groundhog Day. It's not that I don't want to have any fun. I'm just tired of it, to be honest. Plus, the scandal of Dead Willie, you know, over the past year or so, where Willie the albino groundhog died and they didn't tell anybody about it. And now I guess we're getting a brown groundhog, which is fine. I don't care. I don't think there's an accuracy issue there between those two. And then the whole ridiculousness of it is, you know, 6 weeks winter will last. Well, it's going to last 6 weeks anyway. We'll get to the middle of February and things will probably start to warm up a little bit. And snow will melt. And then we'll get back to the way that life should be. And we'll look back and go, eh, it wasn't that bad a winter. And it really hasn't been. We've really only had about 30 days of winter because we got through Christmas without any snow on the ground. That was fine. And then we got into January. Then we had the big dumping. So really, winter has been meh at the very least, or the very worst. If we have another 2 or 3 weeks of that, again, we'll get to March 1st. Temperature starts to go in the right direction. Everything will work out. But I always maintain that if we're going to have a storm, well, let's have a storm, because I suffer from a significant amount of disappointment when I see the weather statements and I see the weather warnings and I think, oh, this will be fun. Because look, I don't have to go anywhere. I'm lucky that way. So I'm thrilled to see it happen. And then when it doesn't happen, I get somewhat disappointed. Tomorrow, we are going to talk to Philippe Fournier. He is, one of the leading prognosticators of elections. Been pretty good at it over the years. We'll talk a little bit about Aaron O'Toole and the challenges that he may be facing. I actually did believe that, you know, over the space, the election was held in September, of course. Then over the next 3 or 4 months, things settled down. It looked like, okay, they're going to take a little bit of time on that, but there is a rump, fairly large rump, of the Conservative Party that is interested in having a leadership review, and that may be the route that it's going for Aaron O'Toole. We'll see. He certainly, at this point, seems to be more inclined to say, yeah, you want to fight? Then we're going to have a fight. So we will talk to Philippe about that tomorrow and a few other things that we are working on. I honestly don't know if I'm back in the studio. I'm kind of getting used to this, though. Back here tomorrow from noon till 3. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.